So for this morning's program, what I intend to do is to give the morning talk about, you know, the endings of retreats and stuff. But then also, I aim to finish about 45-minute talk to about 9 o'clock, and then have a toilet break for 10 or 15 minutes, and then for people to come back for 9:15 to 9:45 to do the metta meditation. It's a long time. If you can't have loving kindness to your own bladder, how can you have loving kindness to anything? So because of that, we just have a little break. But on the ending of retreats, the way that retreats end, I was always impressed with a story one of my Buddhist friends. He was joined the Jogje order in South Korea. They were quite strict. He was a good meditator. You know, many of the Jogje monks come over here, I go over there, so we've got a connection together. In fact, one of those monks, Vinalokahita, should be coming here for the range retreat. And it's really nice to have them as good friends. But anyway, that he went over to South Korea. He got his Buddhist name over there, Hamwol. He's a very nice monk. But then he told me about his first retreat in the Jogje order. And it wasn't like a 9-day retreat, it was a 60-day retreat. And it was very tough. Not like Ajahn Brahms, we can have cushions, and you can get up when you want, go to bed when you want, have delicious, beautiful food, and the teacher tells you jokes. Not like that at all. It was very strict. And so they would, I think, up in the morning at 4 o'clock and start meditating. And they would only do like meditations, 45 minutes or sitting meditation, and 50 minutes walk, another 45 minutes sit, 50-minute walk, but you know, in the main hall. And they also had 3 meals a day instead of the 2 meals here. So in the morning and lunchtime, but the meals were served to them where they sat. So they never went off to the dining room. They sat here, they ate there, and the food was taken away, and then it was back to meditating again. And they could have the opportunity, obviously, to go to the toilet, but also the only other opportunity to leave that hall was actually to see their master, you know, the teacher. And the teacher was really strict. So, you know, they thought maybe best to sit even when their knees were aching than see the master. So anyway, there was a very tough retreat. And at the end of the day, I forget what time they finished meditating, 8, 9 or 10 or something, then they would actually sleep where they were sitting. They would just lay on the floor and they would be allowed to sleep. And then the bell would go off in the morning to wake them up. And that was their day. Day after day after day after day. Now, being able to sit that long, many hours a day, in the same place without much exercise, that was really tough on your knees, your bottom and your back. Even just one day of that, his knees were aching. Are your knees aching now, your back sore? No! I need to be tougher. No, not into it for soreness. But they didn't have any chairs, they all had to sit on the ground. So after one day of meditation, you know, that was really tough. And then the bell went to go to sleep. Then the bell went almost immediately, fell fast asleep straight away, and then woke up again for the morning. Another almost like 20 hours of meditation. They're only allowed to sleep 4 or 5 hours. Another 20 hours of meditation. Oh, that was tough. And he used to meditate quite okay when it wasn't so continuous. But he kept on meditating and meditating and meditating. 2 days went past, 3 days went past. There's only another 57 days to go. And he's like, ah, can I make it? I remember him telling me, because he was a personal friend, I remember him telling me that sometimes that, you know, he thought of running away, getting up, because he wasn't really used to this. But then he'd open his eyes and see all those South Korean monks sitting there perfectly still, very happy, it seemed. And he had like pride. You know, he can't let down the Kiwis. So, you know, he was a New Zealander, so he said, okay, I'll just do another day. And then another day, he got to the first week. And after the first week, you know, he was really in a lot of pain and agony. But then he thought, well, I've done 1 week, maybe I can do another week. You know how that endurance actually happens? You keep on pushing, you keep on trying to see what happens. And so he did 2 weeks. His body was really in pain and just hardly any sort of respite. Went to sleep at night, oh, that was so nice. You know, stretch your legs, lay down, but it just disappeared straight away because he fell asleep. And he woke up again and more meditation. Walk, sit, eat where you're sitting, and then go and see the master and wish you hadn't, and then go back again. And it was such a struggle, he said. Until he got to the halfway mark. He made it to one whole month of that. And he thought, if you've done the halfway mark, the rest is like, you know, the easy part. You've done the worst part. But it doesn't work like that. What happens is the pain starts to increase. Oh, it hurts. Oh, this is difficult. Be minded 5 weeks and 6 weeks. And when he got to 6 weeks, trying to leave now was like being unfaithful to all that he'd endured so far. So he kept on going, 7 weeks. Only one more week to go. Do you recognize that sometimes in your life when you're enduring things and just struggling, but you know, only another week to go. But the last week is always the longest. Every day seemed to be much more than 24 hours. But he got to 6 days of the last week, only one more day to go. And he said when he woke up in the morning, only one more day, what have I done? It's amazing. Just all the endurance which I've accumulated over this retreat so far. And those retreats, at the end of the retreat, once it's all finished, they have a big feast. I mean, really a big feast. Have you got that organized for today, Robin? After the big feast, they have hot baths. Because, you know, hot baths, we've been meditating that long. You know, your knees and your back and everything is just so tense and so inflamed, and you just want to go into a hot bath and just relax. So he was dreaming of his hot bath, a nice feast, you know, all day until he got to the last meditation. Only 45 minutes, the last one. Wow. He's so close, he's not going to give up now. But you know the psychology of this. The last 45 minutes was the longest 45 minutes he'd ever endured in his life. He'd be sitting there and it's like the pain had been holding back for all this time. Now it was giving everything it had. Holding back no punches. Oh, it was just so difficult and so painful, but only a few minutes to go, he thought. And he opened up one eye just to look at the clock. Oh no, it must be more than 5 minutes. I've got another 40 minutes to go. And so he closed his eyes and gritted his teeth again and was enduring and enduring. And that must be another 50 minutes for sure. I opened up his eye and about 2 minutes had gone past. And that's when he started to think, what happens if the batteries in the clock start to run out? What if the clock is going slow? What if the clock actually stops because the batteries have got no power left? And he has to sit there for 3 hours instead of 45 minutes. And he started thinking of all these terrible scenarios. And he wasn't peaceful at all. He was fantasizing. He was dreaming. He was anything to get away from the agony of having to sit for a bit longer. And that last 45 minutes lasted like an eternity. But of course, everything must come to an end. And so the head monk rang the gong. That, he said, was the sweetest sound he'd ever heard in his life. More beautiful than the great symphony orchestras of the world. More... Oh, that was just bliss. Oh, bring on the hot bath. Bring on the food. Oh, I really deserve this. And he was going to really pig out because he deserved it. He earned it. And then what happened? The head monk said, excuse me a moment. I have an announcement. Many of you have had a wonderful retreat. Have you had a wonderful retreat? Good. Well, many of the monks here said they've had a wonderful retreat. And they'd asked me, special permission, seeing I was at such a beautiful retreat, making so much progress, can we extend the retreat for another week? And I was thinking about this, and I think it's a good idea. Close your eyes, carry on meditating. And this monk told me, he said, I never felt any pain after that. I just felt anger. And I was thinking about all the pain I was going to inflict on them when I found out who those couple of monks were who wanted to extend this retreat. Oh, they're going to really be in big trouble. What they did to me, I can't stand for. This is unfair. It's promised, isn't it? 60 days and then a nice feast and a hot bath and get this, another week of this. This is impossible. You can't do that. And then the bell went again. And about 20 minutes had gone past on the clock. Like nothing, like a second. But 20 minutes had gone past. And the head monk said, retreat over. The hot baths are down there. The feast is on. Off you go. And how... This monk, first retreat he'd done, said, well, is it over? Is it not over? What's going on? He said it was over, now it's not over. And then one of the junior monks came up to him and said to him, that the master, the great teacher, he does the same trick every year. And Han Wald said he learned more about meditation in that last 20 minutes than he'd done in 60 days. Anticipation. You think the retreat's over, or going to be over in a couple of hours. But as you said, you really enjoyed this retreat. So, unpack your bags. But can you see just how we do anticipate? And we sort of guess the future or expect the future. And that's where most of the suffering comes from. You know, even when he thought just half the retreat time is gone, 30 days are gone, the rest must be easy. Only another day to go, this must be okay, I can do this. And even the last day was worse than the whole 59 days which preceded it. That's sometimes what we learn by trying to plan for the future. And at this particular time, near the end of the retreat. Have you got any plans? What are you going to do next? If you've heard and understood anything on this retreat, yeah, you probably will go home this afternoon or this morning or wherever. But don't have hard and fast plans. Because sometimes those hard and fast plans, when they're disappointed, and it doesn't turn out as you expected, that's actually where you find that you have lots of suffering and pain. You learn, hopefully, to live in this present moment, to enjoy this present moment, to care for this present moment. And by caring for this present moment, you find you're doing the very, very best for the future. As I often say, your future is being made right now. And sometimes at the end of the retreat we forget that. We think that all these things which you do on a retreat are only for retreat time. They're not. many of them you apply in your daily life. The little things like being kind to yourself, being kind to your neighbour, being quiet, being peaceful, and just not being afraid. Some people here, you know, they've got really good jobs, and sometimes that they have to give talks, you know, they give talks, you know, in a company setting. You've got to motivate your the people who work with you and work for you. And sometimes that's hard, giving public talks, so people said. For me, when I started giving public talks, I started, you know, looking and said, well, if I give a really good talk and people like it and it inspires and makes people better human beings, that's a wonderful thing to be able to give. It gives me so much more fulfillment. But if people don't like my talks, if the talks are too much poo in them, then the bad jokes or whatever, that's even better. Then I can be a nice hermit. I don't get bothered by anybody. I just sit in my hut. When they ask who's going to give the talk, I'm like, oh, Metiji, you give the talk. Or, oh, Venerable Gotami, you give the talk. So I always looked at it, both ways I win. But they didn't employ you to be a speaker. They employed you to be able to manage other things in your company. So because of that, I became a monk so I could meditate. Not so I could sit here and talk all day. I think I talk too much. And that is absolutely true. You can ask, well, the only member of my family really left who can actually say it's true is my brother. But I was very shy when I was young. I was just very quiet. I was a very quiet, good little boy. Hardly talked at all. Now look at me. I can't stop. That reminds me of, many of you from Malaysia may remember Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda. He came here quite a few times, a very lovely monk. But when he was, you know, got sick, you know, at the very end of his life, they put him in a hospital and they just decided to, you know, make sure he had some solitude and silence, you know, so he could do the best chances to recover. But then he got hold of a mobile phone somewhere and rang up saying, can you come and see me? I'm not talking. I'm missing something in my life. He was making a funny scene about it, but he was so used to talking to people. You know, either public talks or giving advice or receiving guests and something. So being in a hospital and not being able to talk to anybody, that was really suffering for him. Maybe the same might be for me. No, it was just what you get used to. And it's also, he thought, you know, being silent or being talking at his stage of the life was not going to mean any difference at all. So he just wanted to give and serve one last time. So little by little, that we learn from what we learn here, we tend to put into practice in our lay life, whatever we can do. One of the most important things, which I talked to you, I mean, I said, now I did the how heavy is the cup thing, didn't I? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. And hopefully here you've learned how to put it down for a little while to rest. Doesn't matter how much responsibility you have, you can actually put things down and rest. And one of the greatest examples of that which I've seen was an Ajahn Chah's funeral. So they did the service with all the dignitaries there and all that sort of stuff in the afternoon. And in the evening, that's when they lit the funeral pyre. And when they lit the funeral pyre, it all went wrong. Because what happened? The funeral pyre was in that great chaidya, just like at That Pa Non on the Mekong River. And spent a lot of time and effort making this chaidya. And they had a metal box, a big metal box, really strong, put the coffin inside that and all the wood in there with a nice chimney going up so it could actually burn inside the chaidya. And it went wrong. It was Ajahn Liam who designed it. Ajahn Liam got all of the engineers to make sure it would, you know, it would work. Ajahn Liam was built everything and made sure it was all done, you know, brilliantly. And then this was the cremation of his teacher. And now fortunately the king had gone home by this time, the king of Thailand and the queen and all the dignitaries. And when they lit it, it was so hot inside the metal cabinet. The metal cabinet, because I was there at the time and saw it, and it started glowing red. And then you can hear it cracking, and fissures started to come out, open up in the metal container where Ajahn Brahm's... Wishful thinking. Where Ajahn Chah's body was being cremated. And as those openings came, then flames started coming out, and the cracks got bigger, and it looked like the whole thing was going to just burst into flames. You know, not just the inside, which is supposed to burst into flames inside, but outside as well. And the whole edifice would come crumbling down. And that would have been a national event. And I remember seeing Ajahn Liam. He was the one who built it. He was the one who designed it. The one who took responsibility for it. I saw him looking at it, shrugging his shoulders, and going back to his kuti to go to bed. He was tired. Did my best. That's the best I could do. So, see what happens. It's ability to let go. You know, of a big event in your life, you know, looking after your teacher, and seeing it all go terribly wrong. That was really impressive. And that's why sometimes if I see things go wrong here, or with the committee, or oops, I shouldn't, there's too many committee members here. Oh, you did your best. In other words, you can let go of responsibility, not worry about it, and you just disappear. And other monks got out the hoses and hosed it all down, it's hard work, but put out the fire, and everything eventually was fine. But I always remember that, the ability of the one in charge, the one most responsible, saying he's been working all day, looking after guests, making sure everything was working okay, and this goes wrong at the very end, okay. He went to bed and rested. Can you do that? If you can, then you've got something from this retreat. You try your very best at work. You try your very best in the organization. But some things are some things beyond your control, beyond what you can do. And so what do? You don't fight battles you can never win. You let go. And it's an amazing thing that when Ajahn Liam let go, it wasn't as big a catastrophe as I expected. We managed to hose everything down, and you know, the coffin burnt, and it was all perfect in the end. A bit of soot marks inside the main stupa, which shouldn't be there, but they were all cleaned up afterwards. So it was okay. So it's never demand perfection in life. And that brings me on to the second story about the end of retreats. And that second story, the end of retreats, that was the old sailor and the professor. And again, I'm sorry if you happen to be a professor, because professor always lose out on these stories. And simple people are the ones who win. And it's nothing against professors, it's just that sometimes, as I often say, that never allow your learning and your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Sometimes we get brainwashed that this is the way that life is, this is the way that science says it can be, and we can't think outside the box. As a meditator, we're always thinking outside the box. I've got a cartoon in my hut, and the only person who's not allowed to think outside the box was this cat. And his owner was just going off to work and showing the cat the litter box and telling the cat, don't think outside the box. do your business in here. But anyway, the old man and the professor. These were the days when, if you were a professor and giving lectures overseas, you would go in a boat. There were no aircraft to travel in. So you would go in a liner somewhere. So it's going from Perth over to where to Colombo. Colombo, good idea? Yes, many Sri Lankans here, so I should say Colombo. So you're going from Perth to Colombo. And a few days in the boat. And the first night at sea, the professor had a lovely dinner and then went for a walk on the deck. And it was a beautiful still night on the ocean. And so as he was walking up on the deck, he saw this old sailor, decided to have a conversation with the old man. And the professor said, "Old man, how long have you been sailing on this ocean?" "All my life, since I was about 14 years of age," said the old man. "Marvelous," he said. "I see you've been looking down into the ocean, into the sea. That's one of my hobbies, sort of the marine science. You must have seen some strange animals who inhabit the ocean. You know, whales and dolphins and sharks and all octopuses." Is it octopuses or octopies? Maybe because I'm hungry. But no. No, I won't tell you. Should I tell the octopus joke? Okay. It's not a very nice joke, but it's funny.
Does it involve poo?
Does it? Does not involve poo. So the guy at the zoo, aquarium, whatever you call it, said, "Let's go and clean out the octopus cage." So he went out to the octopus cage and opened the door. He had to get the octopus out of the cage before he could clean it. And the octopus didn't want to go. So the octopus, you know, eight tentacles, grabbed on to, you know, each arm onto the bars of the cage. So the guy, the new guy, tried to pull the tentacles, whatever you call it, off the arms of the octopus. He got two or three off, and then when he was trying to get another one off, the octopus reattached the ones which were free. And so it was a half an hour, 45 minutes, and couldn't get the octopus out of the cage. So he went back to his boss and said, "I can't get the octopus to leave the cage, so I can't clean it." And then the head keeper sort of gave him a spade. "Take this." And then he went to the doctor. He didn't actually ask what the spade was to be used for. "So use it as a lever to try and get the octopus's tentacles off the bars." He got about four or five off, but when he got four or five off, then the other ones would attach, and he couldn't get them all off enough to get him out. So he went back to the head keeper and said, "Look, it doesn't work, this method using a spade." He said, "How did you use it?" "Well, I tried to lever the tentacles off the bars." And the head keeper said, "That's not how you use it. How do you use it? I'll show you. It's very easy." He went to the octopus cage, and the head keeper got hold of the spade, whack, on top of that poor octopus's head. And the octopus, eight hands, "Ow!" I know Buddhist monks shouldn't be talking about how to torture octopuses. Sorry. Anyway, so the old man said, "No, I don't know anything about octopuses or sharks or anything in the ocean. I'm just a sailor, that's all." "You mean all that life at sea, you've never bought to get a book out and learn about all the animals and the fish in the ocean you're on every day?" "Nope." "You stupid old man, what a waste of the life," said the professor, and walked away in disgust. And professors are like this, sometimes they're very proud. And so, the next night at sea, a very nice meal. And this night at sea, And after a very nice meal, the professor went on deck, the old man was there. And when you've had a good lunch or a good dinner, you always feel in a better mood. So the professor said, I'll give him another chance. Because he saw that the old man was looking up at the stars in the sky. He said to the old man, you know, that's one of my really good hobbies, astronomy. What? Said the old man, the old sailor. Astronomy, the stars. Look at all those lights above you. All the galaxies and meteors and planets and stuff. You know, you must use those stars to guide your ship. Or maybe the captain does, but not me, said the sailor, the old man. What? He said. All these years at sea, and you never bothered to learn about the stars in the heavens above you? Nope, said the old sailor. You really are a stupid old man. Stupid old man. What a waste of a life. What a waste of a life. Third night at sea. And I say, when I tell the story, I say, don't worry, there's only a little ways to go. Third night at sea. There was this beautiful breeze wafting over the ocean. And it was fragrant, it was cooling, it was like idyllic. And that put the professor in such a good mood, he decided to give the old man one very last chance. And he said, old man, you know, I'm a professor of meteorology. I'm going to go and give some lectures in Colombo, in Sri Lanka, on the weather. And the weather is really important to you. I know maybe the stars and the animals in the ocean underneath, maybe not so important. But the weather drives the sails of your ship. It must be really important to you. You must know a lot by all your experience about meteorology. Nope! I know nothing. I don't even know how to spell meteorology. Meteor what? And the professor said, you really are a stupid old man. A very stupid old man. An extremely stupid old man. What a waste of a life. What a waste of a life. What a waste of a life. And the professor walked away. And again, in Buddhism, especially stories, you only do things three times. So that's the end of him walking up on top of the deck. Because the next night, he didn't even have a dinner. Because there was... That little breeze was a sign of actually a storm coming the next night. And the next night there was a very quite violent storm at sea. And the professor, he suffered from seasickness. So he decided not to have any lunch. He stayed in his cabin all night. And as the night wore on, get closer and closer to the midnight, 1 a.m., the storm got worse and worse. And the ship was rolling back and forth, back and forth. And then suddenly, bang! Was that loud? None of you. Shad, don't get... I need better visual effects here. Anyway, it was a big bang. And everything was quiet for a sudden, for a moment. And the professor wondered what was happening. And he heard somebody running outside his cabin door. So he opened the door. And who was it running outside his cabin door? The old sailor. And the old sailor stopped, looked to the professor, who was just so afraid, and said to the professor, Professor, in all your life, have you ever learnt how to swim? Swimming? No, actually, I don't know how to swim. You stupid old professor, what a waste of a life. The ship is sinking. And of course, I like that story simply because it's great, you know, to have an interest in marine science or astronomy or meteorology. But the most important thing if you're a sailor is to learn to keep your head above water when the ship sinks, to be able to swim. The same in life. Doesn't matter what career you have, in IT, in sweeping the floors, in I don't know what other jobs you do over here, in being a monk, whatever or none, whatever job you have, the most important job is being able to keep your head above water in the difficulties of your life, which we all must face. Not to drown, but to swim. I kind of like that simile, because it shows that when you come on one of these meditation retreats, you think, well, I'll never be a monk or a nun, but there's a lot of to be gained and to be learned, you know, from these retreats. Things which you do use in your daily life. And the thing about how heavy the glass of water, when you do put it down, you find, and you can find this from your own personal experience, you gain energy and clarity. So whatever you do is done more efficiently. I can notice this when I get tired. I waste a lot of time. You're trying to, you know, even read sort of an email, or trying to compose, you know, some forward for some book. You're trying to do something, and the words don't come up. You're wasting time. That's why I tell many students, if that's you, you're staying up late at night to finish an assignment, then when you feel tired, exhausted, just turn off that computer and actually listen to some music or something. Have a rest. Even better to meditate, that's the best. And if you can do that, then you find that you rest for half an hour and afterwards your mind is clear and you do very well. That's how it works. So you learn lots of wisdom on these retreats. And it's wisdom which, you know, some other people just, they don't know how you access it. One of those pieces of wisdom, which I remember, it was actually from, again, the history of Thailand in the old days, very old days. Because, you know, they had kings and they had ministers, you know, ruling the countries. This was actually when Thailand was around, I think, Sukhothai area. So anyway, when the king had a very, very smart minister, like everybody else, like in government, or like your office, people in control, there's always one who like knows it all. Now the person who's really arrogant, smart aleck, and is always right. And so they decided to, the other ministers, they met in secret and said, how can we get rid of this guy? You know, he's just always causing us a headache, and unfortunately he's always right. So they were smart themselves. They said, what we know he's very arrogant and proud. So we're going to build up his pride a little bit more and then see if we can catch him in this trap. And what the trap was, I'll tell you in a moment. The next day, they just praised him. And in front of the king said, you're so lucky and fortunate to have this minister who's so smart. He's a great asset to you. He knows so much about everything. And every time the minister said, yes, yeah, that's me, I know everything about everything, I'm so smart. He never makes a mistake. No, I never make a mistake. He's really so smart. Yeah, I'm always smart. You probably know what each of us ministers is thinking about the king. And the minister said, yeah, I know what they're all thinking. I know what they think every day. That was the trap. So, well, what are we thinking? How can you prove that you know how what somebody is thinking? Because they're all going to deny it. Even if that minister did figure out just what each of the other ministers were thinking, they'd always deny it. So, no, you're wrong. No, you're wrong. No, you're wrong. What happened in front of the king when they asked him, what are we all thinking? The minister, the wise guy, just paused for a moment and said, each one of you, all in your different ways, are thinking kind thoughts towards His Majesty. And then all the ministers said, yes. Otherwise they'd get their head chopped off. And apparently that really happened. Now that's kind of wisdom. in a funny sense. And apparently it happened many, 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 many years ago. But anyway, that wisdom is something which you can do at work. The other thing which I... So you can, when your boss, you know, says, why should I employ you? You say, because I know what everyone thinks in this office. What's that? They're always thinking kind, wonderful thoughts towards you, our boss. But anyway, that's why when you ask me, Ajahn Brahm, can you read our thoughts? Yes. You are thinking kind, wonderful thoughts. In my dreams. So little by little, we get the wisdom. But one thing to say before we stop for a toilet break, one thing which I hope you've learnt here is the power of kindness. It's not just your effort. It's not just how strong you are. It's not just how committed you are. It's also just how wise you are. Because that wisdom is actually how you can perform now much, much better than everybody else, except for the ones who also come here. But most of the people, they just don't know if they want to achieve something or get somewhere or go somewhere. They don't know how to get there in a way which is the most efficient, easy and beneficial. Sometimes you may get the job done, but at what cost to you and your mental health? That's why all these little stories about how to relax and be peaceful, even with sicknesses like COVID and diseases like depressions and OCDC. I actually got that right, didn't I? I usually say ACDC. ODC?
ACD.
Okay, well, I don't know. Whatever those diseases are, that sometimes we can find a way of like, of kindness, of an acceptance. And I've seen that a few times, that parents or friends, they get people who come, and our Sangha here, the people who want to ordain, they're really good people, but they may be schizophrenic, they may be really old, they may be, in the old days, there was a law in Thailand that monks were not allowed to ordain if they were gay. And I thought, why not? Because I knew quite a few gay Buddhists who were marvellous people, really helpful. And so when one of them, he said, this was quite a long time ago, he wanted to join Bodhinyana Monastery. And I had to think, I had to keep it quiet because otherwise, some of those really, really, really senior monks in Thailand may have been getting on my back and causing trouble. But I said, let's give it a try. And I asked him little questions. If you saw a man come into this monastery and a really, 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 you looked at him and it really aroused your lust, what would you do? What he said was, I'd go to my heart and just lay down. I'll disappear for a while until I can control my emotions. It's a sort of answer which I thought, he was being realistic as a young monk just starting out. And that's what he did. And now he's a senior monk, I won't say where, and he's a very inspiring monk. It's one of those things, I always thought, why not, and you proved it. Other monks who were schizophrenic, gave them a chance, and they rose to the occasion. And they're great monks now. All these people you give a chance to, and that's actually how you grow in compassion, leadership, and you teach by example. Why should you exclude anybody? There has to be a reason for exclusion. not just a reason for inclusion. And that's the sort of the general compassion and kindness and wisdom of our system. You call it a system. But anyway, that is something I'm very happy with over all these years. To be able to create a society, a Buddhist society, which is very successful, but which is very open and accepting. That's why, you know, we accept so much. That's also why, you know, at the end of a retreat, I was going to say this, I better say it quickly because I'm running out of time. At the end of the retreat, you know, we always have to pay the bills. And so that's one of the reasons why there's a story of this young monk. And when he started his temple, it's very hard for him to get enough donations to actually to pay the bills. So he's really struggling. And then he asked the senior monk, how do you do it when you start out? When you start out in a nun's monastery, how do you actually start out to pay the bills? And the old monk says, it's very easy. What I did, he said, I'd make sure when I gave a talk, I made sure I closed all the windows and the doors, made it stuffy, turned on the heaters, made it warm, and gave a very boring talk. No jokes. And when the talk was really, really boring, and it was hot, then I'd get out my little watch, backwards and forwards, and I'd hypnotize all my congregation and say, you're feeling sleepy. Sleepy, the best way to overcome sloth and torpor is not to fight it. When I think we've got them all hypnotized, I say, as you go out the door, remember, no coins in the donation box, no fives, no tens or twenties, only fifties and hundreds. And he said, I can't do that. It's encouraging good karma. That's what you're supposed to do. So he tried it. Look at the stick. After the talk, he looked at the donation box. It was packed with 50s and hundreds. He cleaned up. So at the end of the talk, he counted it all. He can't do it every week because they'll soon figure him out and notice the trick. So he waited until he needed some more money. And then he closed all the windows, the doors, made it warm, gave a boring talk, got out his watch. And it was when they're getting very sleepy. When you leave the hall, you will own it. And he dropped his watch. It went bang on the floor. And he said, oh shit. And he got what he deserved. Okay. It was a poo joke. That's for you. Okay. So that's enough for that. It's now just gone 9. So if you want to go and just to do some letting go, and come in here by 9:15, and then we'll do loving kindness meditation talk to finish off. Ha ha ha.